Hello everybody, welcome to this lecture. It's covering Henry Hazlitt's book, Foundations of Morality. In case any of you thought the lecture is going to be on the English literary critic William Hazlitt, you've come to the wrong lecture. This is on Henry Hazlitt. Now before I get started, Danny Sanchez mentioned that he wants to say a few words about a very special offer that the Mises Academy is going to be giving this summer. So, Danny, would you like to give the special offer?
Sure. I just want to let everybody know that we're having a sale, that the prices that we just had just a few minutes ago are going down by 50%. So it's a big sale. We're hoping that you'll enroll in a lot of the summer classes. And if for those of you who have already paid the full price, you should be getting a partial refund so that you're getting the sale price too. And check it out, academy.mises.org. And David Gordon himself has political philosophy through the ages, which is a great course. And later in the summer, he's doing a course on Atlas Shrugged. So, thank you.
Okay, now that sounds like a good deal. See, if you get the courses for 50% off, you can use the 50% you save to spend on the course, so then the course won't cost you anything. I'm expecting laughter for that. All right. I think this course, we're going to be dealing with Henry Hazlitt's book, The Foundations of Morality. Now, we want to raise a question first. Why are we talking about foundations of morality in this lecture? And if you take a course in ethical theory, probably Hazlitt's book is not one you're going to get on the reading list. He's not one of the major figures in philosophy, so you don't get courses in ethics that, say, deal with Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, Hume, Kant, and Hazlitt. Why am I looking away from the camera? Because I'm looking at my slides, I think. Hazlitt is not one you get in most philosophy courses, but I think, and I'm going to try to show during the talk today, that it is an important book, and it's one that Hazlitt had thought very deeply about the foundations of ethics and morality. I think he has very valuable things to say. In the lecture, I'm going to be primarily concerned with presenting what Hazlitt's view is rather than giving problems with it or trying to give arguments for it or against it. I'm more concerned here with exposition of the view. One thing I should mention just in passing, for those of you who've not come to my lectures before, I must warn you, one of the people who listened to my lecture say, I sound like Droopy Dog on sleeping pills, so make sure you don't fall asleep during the lecture. I'm trying to make it as enthusiastic as I can, but my speaking voice isn't the most animated in the world. So as I say, Foundation of Morality is an important book, and the economist Leland Yeager, who is also knows a great deal about philosophy, has written on foundations of ethics himself, considers Hazlitt's Foundations of Morality an extremely important book, and I think he's right about that. An additional reason I think we should be interested in Hazlitt's book is that the approach to morality that Hazlitt develops in the book is very close to the one that Ludwig von Mises developed. Now, Mises doesn't have anywhere a full-length discussion of ethics. He discusses ethics, I think, probably the most in his book, Socialism. He has quite a bit to say about it, but he never has a full-length treatise on ethics. So if you want a Misesian ethics, or ethics as Mises would have developed it, Hazlitt's book is a very good place to go, because Hazlitt's position is very much in line with that of von Mises. They're probably not perfectly identical, but they're very, very close. And in fact, Mises read the manuscript of Hazlitt's book. So in addition to the importance of the book, just for studying Hazlitt's view, it's very good as giving you some indication of what Mises' ethics is. Now, I think it's a fairly long book, but I think we can see the book as trying to answer two related questions. One is, what makes things morally right or wrong or good or bad? Say we say things like stealing is wrong or murder is wrong. It's good to be honest. It's good to be truthful. How do we know which things are the good and bad things, the morally right and wrong things? What is it that makes things good or bad? And then the related question is, why should we do what morality prescribes? Suppose, as an example, suppose I don't want to. Suppose somebody said, you shouldn't lie to people. Suppose I feel like lying. Why shouldn't I? Suppose that it appears that it's in my interest to violate a moral rule. Suppose I could steal a lot of money without anyone finding out. Why shouldn't I? And we would have the question, what does should mean in this question? I say, why shouldn't I? Doesn't mean why morally shouldn't I? Because if it's stipulated it's wrong to steal, then it wouldn't make sense to say, why shouldn't I steal if you know stealing is wrong? But here it would mean something like, what reason is there do I have for following the rules of morality? Now, in this photo, this I take is intended to picture famous, this is like taken from the Tolkien Lord of the Rings. It's taken to picture a famous example that Plato gives in the Republic, where he imagines somebody has called the Ring of Gyges, which is a ring that if you put it on, it makes you invisible, so you could do whatever you want without being detected. So if you had such a ring, would you have reason still to follow the rules of morality? Maybe you could get away with all sorts of things that you couldn't get away with. People could see you. So this is a very good way to raise this question. Why should we do what morality prescribes? So those are two questions Hazlitt going to be trying to answer in the book, is what makes things good and bad or right or wrong, and why should we do what morality says we should do? Now, as most of you may, or at least many of you, I hope, have read Hazlitt's most famous book, which is called Economics in One Lesson. And Hazlitt, as you know, was in his career primarily an economic journalist. H.L. Mencken said about Hazlitt, he's the only economist who can write. So Hazlitt is very, very easy to follow. But if you remember from Economics in One Lesson, that book was really an update of a famous essay by Frederick Bastiat called What is Seen and What is Unseen. Hazlitt was stressing the need to take all the consequences of economic policy into account. And so sometimes people will propose a certain measure, say, well, we should have prosperity by government spending a lot of money, and they'll just consider the immediate effects of the measure, but they don't consider the long-term effects or what would have happened if they hadn't put in the policy. For example, labor unions might raise wages for some workers, but so people say, oh, isn't this good? The labor union's got people in the union higher wages, but it could result in unemployment for other people. So what Hazlitt was saying in Economics in One Lesson is you have to take account of all the effects of a measure if you're going to, economic measure, you're going to consider that it's a good measure. So this distinction makes between immediate or short run versus long run consequences, as I say, is crucial to that book. And I think what we can see in Foundations and Morality is Hazlitt is using that point, namely that you have to take account of the long run consequences of things, not just the immediate consequences, you have to take account of all the consequences, especially the long run consequences. He's using that to help explain morality. So he say, so Hazlitt really had this important point about economics, and he's going to say the foundations of morality. It isn't just a point about economics. We can use it in helping us answer both what the things are good and bad or right and wrong and why we should do what morality says. Now, what Hazlitt is trying to respond to with both these questions is what I think one could call the problem of moral arbitrariness. Suppose we have moral rules like you ought not to steal or you ought not to kill. So question would come up, why are these different from statements like you ought to give me all your money? I think that would be an excellent idea. I'd be happy to give my mail address to anyone who wants to send me all your money. But suppose I said that, you did not as a joke, I said you ought to give me all your money. You would say, well, why should I? It seems like just an arbitrary statement in this picture we have. Somebody saying, give me your ball. I'm going to stop myself from making remarks about that one. That would get me into too much trouble. So the question is, moral rules are just things like they're just commands, they're just saying, you should do this, you should do that. But why are they different from just arbitrary statements that you say you ought to get up and walk out the door, you ought to do this? What makes them things that we really ought to do rather than just arbitrary statements? So what Hazlitt says is if we're to avoid this problem of groundless or arbitrary ought, we have to find some basis in reality for these oughts. We have to find some basis for them. So people won't just say, well, okay, you say I ought not to steal. Why is this any different from the man who says, give me your ball? Yes, never mind that one. Now, so Hazlitt says we have to give the ground in reality for our ought, but there's a problem here. Didn't David Hume show that a statement about an ought can't be logically derived from statements about just about is? And here's a picture of Hume over there in this slide. Hume, I should say, of the great philosophers, he was the second faddist. I think the faddist of the great philosophers was Aquinas, who was so fat that when he would celebrate Mass, there had to be a special part of the altar cut away so he could fit in. But Hume was pretty fat. In fact, there's one story about Hume that Hume was never married, but the story was he was once thinking of getting married, and he was proposing to a woman who got down on one knee to propose to him, and he couldn't get up again, so she just laughed at him and never did get married. And so what Hume said is something like this. He said, if you take just statements, descriptive statements about the world, he wanted to know how could you get a statement about what ought to be the case if you don't have any statements about what ought to be the case in the premises. He wanted to know how could you get to an ought in the conclusion. It would be something like, his argument would be something like, suppose I have a lot of statements that don't say anything about oranges, so my conclusion won't have anything about oranges in it either, because there's nothing about oranges in the premise. So Hume thinks, or at least he strongly suggests, although there's some people who read him differently, if you don't have oughts in, start off with oughts, you're not going to be able to get an ought in the conclusion. Now, some people don't think his argument works, but as it really doesn't say much, if anything, about Hume's argument. I don't think he would disagree with Hume's point just in the way Hume framed it, but he didn't say anything about, he didn't really challenge Hume. Then if he didn't do that, so then he seems confronted with a difficulty. He wants to say that your ought have to be based in reality, but how can that be the case if you can't derive an ought from an is? So how are you going to say they're based in reality? So say some people, there are Aristotelians who say you can get an ought from an is in some way, but Hazlitt doesn't really take that line. So he has this problem, how does he base the ought in reality? How does he avoid Hume's problem? So the way he gets his answers, he says, well, there is a basis in reality for one kind of ought statement. And this, he wouldn't be in any trouble with Hume for saying this. And these ought statements are in the form, if you want X, then you ought to do Y. So these are objectively true. For example, if you want to become a doctor, you ought to or should go to medical school. I guess here we're supposed to have a picture of a doctor looking at the arm of a little girl. There are comments I could make on this picture, but at least it's not as bad as the one with the man who said, give me your ball, but this one could occasion some funny comments too, which I'd better not give. Okay, so we have these ought judgments of the form, if you want X, then you ought to do Y, and these are objectively true. Okay. It's not just somebody's feeling, say, that if you want to become a doctor, you ought to go to medical school. That's true that that's the way you become a doctor. Now, Kant, who's not someone that Hazlitt particularly admires, calls these statements, these ought judgments, hypothetical imperatives. They're hypothetical, they're saying, if you want something, then you should do something else. So these hypotheticals can be objectively true. Now, Hazlitt is right about that. These art judgments are objectively true. But how does this help him solve the problem of providing grounds for morality? I should say, this is a picture of Kant on the right. I think it's either that or Dr. Frankenstein. So I suspect it's Kant. So we have these hypotheticals say, if you want X, then you should do Y. But what happens if you say, well, I don't want X? Well, I say, if you want to become a doctor, you should go to medical school. Well, what if I don't want to become a doctor? So how is that? What if I just say I don't care about the if clause? So how is this going to help us ground our moral judgment, our moral statements in reality? How is this hypothetical going to be of any use to Hazlitt? After all, moral judgment don't seem to be hypotheticals. They say, do X, like be honest, or do not steal. They don't say, if you want X, do Y. They're not hypotheticals. So how is this going to help us? I should say, I see people are typing. I'm going to try to allow quite a lot of time for questions, but try to answer the questions or evade them after the lecture. Now, Hazlitt's answer is that there's something that everybody does accept. It's hard to specify. Does he mean absolutely everybody would want this, or nearly everybody, or nearly everybody if he thought about it? It's not quite clear, at least not clear to me, exactly how he wants to specify what he means. But he means something like pretty much everybody wants this thing. So he's going to say, well, I can come up with a hypothetical that you're not going to be able to refuse the if clause. It won't be something like saying, if you want to become a doctor, you should go to medical school. So somebody could say, okay, that doesn't affect me because I don't want to become a doctor. Hazlitt says there's something he can come up with that everybody or nearly everybody does accept. And what is that? It's that people want what's in their long-term interest. So everybody wants what is in his interest in the long run. I suppose I should say his or her interest, because we have to be politically correct these days. So everybody wants what is in his or her long-term interest. And morality tells us how to get this. It gives us an indispensable principle that will enable us to achieve our long-run interest, and everybody wants that. So that will answer these two questions. They'll tell us, by considering what do people need to get their long-run interests, we'll be able to get what are the principles of right and wrong, or good and bad. And we'll also have an answer to why we should care about those principles, because we want what's in our long-term interest in morality. Will tell us how to get that. Now, I put in a kind of a long quotation from Hazlitt. Got the top part of it blocked here. I can't see something like, if you want to avoid lung cancer, you must cut down on cigarettes. So the generalized form of such advice may be reduced to this. You desire to attain a certain end, you ought to use a certain means, because this is the means most likely to achieve it. The is the desire, the ought is the means of gratifying it. So far, so good. but how far does this get us toward a theory of ethics? So this is what I, this is what Hazlitt is saying, this is what I've been trying to summarize. So he's saying you have a hypothetical judgment, you want to avoid lung cancer, and there's a means to achieve it, namely avoiding cigarettes. So this, you have something that's objectively true, and then you say, well, how does it get destroyed this theory of ethics? Then you have here someone who's not taking this advice, who's puffing up a storm. I remember, you know, seeing this picture of someone smoking. Tolstoy once wrote an essay suggesting the reason Kant wrote in such a involved, hard to read style was that he was a heavy smoker. He smoked a pipe, and Tolstoy said, well, if Kant hadn't been a smoker, maybe he would have written more clearly and we could have understood what he was saying better. So Hazlitt then said, it's not true that no amount of is can make an art. So here he's, I don't think, this sounds like a challenge to Hume, but I don't think he really is challenging what Hume meant when he said that, because then Hume was rejecting hypothetical art. But Hazlitt said, the art rests in fact and must rest either upon an is or will be. The sequence is simple. Every man in his cool and rational moment seeks his own long-run happiness. This is a fact, this is an is. So he's saying everybody wants his long-run happiness. And then we have the famous statue, Rodin, the thinker here. I guess that statue doesn't want anything because statues can't have desires. Well, I thought that was funny. And then he says, well, we found over the centuries that certain rules of action best tend to promote the long-run happiness of both the individual and society. These rules of happiness have come to be called moral rules. Therefore, assuming that one seeks one long-run happiness, these are the rules one ought to follow. So you see how Hazlitt is fitting this right into this way of justifying morality, saying we can have hypothetical oughts that are objectively true. If you want something, then you should do this. He says, well, everybody does want his long-run happiness, and the moral rules tell you how to get it. So now that was the end of that quotation from Hazlitt. Now, suppose that Hazlitt is right. People do want to promote their long-term interests. But does this really help us actually come up with the rules of morality? Because we could say, don't people have very different interests? How it suppose everybody is interested in promoting his own long-run happiness, but won't people have different ideas on what will make them happy? So if you want to say the rules of morality are common code, they tell us they're general rules that apply to everybody. So how would Hazlitt's point really help him solve the problem? Because he said, well, everybody wants his long-term, to promote his long-term interest, everybody wants to be happy. But what if people want to be happy in different ways? How do we get general rules of morality? And Hazlitt's answer here, which I think is really the key point in understanding his approach to morality, is that there's one institution. By institution, I don't mean something like a mental institution. It's something like a kind of a systematic way people have of behaving in society. Because there's one institution that enables everyone to promote his or her interest. You notice I use the politically correct term his or her. And without this institution, everybody would be much worse off. So what Hazlitt is saying is everybody wants to be happy in the long run, we have different ways of wanting to be happy. In fact, Hazlitt thinks things just become good because we want them. He doesn't think there are things that we objectively ought to want. He thinks if we want things, it's just because they're desired. But he says, even though people have all these conflicting desires for different sorts of things, say some people like classical music, some people like hip-hop music, all sorts of different conflicting tastes and preferences that people have. He says, there's one institution that will help you achieve your desires for long-run happiness, regardless of how what these desires are. And this institution, this pattern of behavior, is social cooperation through the market. And we can see what Hazlitt means in this way. Supposing we didn't have an economic system, there was no market, say everybody had to produce everything by themselves. Say, I had to grow, say if you wanted to eat, you had to go out and grow your own food, or you had to build your own house. Most people wouldn't be able to do very much at all, and probably very few people would be alive if you had this work. No one could make exchanges. So the way we're able to survive is we can cooperate with each other, say instead of each person having to produce everything by himself, we can just specialize in one thing. This is what's called division of labor. And by trading with other people, by peacefully cooperating with them, people are enabled to achieve their goals much better than they could if they just had to rely on their own efforts. So social cooperation through the market is, according to Hazlitt, also according to von Mises, is really the key institution that we need in order to try to get our long run, achieve our long run interest in happiness. So how do we get morality out of this? All we've said so far is that we need to have the free market, or we need to have a market where people make exchanges. But what does that have to do with morality? How does this get us a system of moral rules that people ought to follow? Well, the answer to that is we're now within reach of the theory. The real heart of the theory is that if we want to have a market because people need social cooperation in order to try to become happy, to achieve their long-run interest. And so we need to have a market where people can make exchanges with each other. And in order to have a market, people need to follow certain rules. For example, to respect the property of others. Say people aren't going to make exchanges with you if they think you're going to try to steal what they produce as soon as they have their back to it. So we need to follow certain rules in order to have a market, and we need to have a market because social cooperation is the basis that we can attain our happiness. Now, suppose you see an opportunity to steal. Let's say you're in a store and you see the cash register is open and the store and has just gone to the back, cash register is just burst open, you can just take the money out. You have good reason to think he won't be able to catch you. So you might think, well, isn't this in your immediate interest that you'd be able to get all this money and nobody's going to catch you? But it isn't, according to Hazlitt, it isn't in your long run interest, because in order for the market and self-cooperation to function, people really have to follow these rules on a fixed basis. They kind of have to have these rules internalized or taught to us so that we just don't violate them whenever we think we could get away with it. If we did that, then the social cooperation would break down. So it's in everybody's interest that we always follow these fixed rules, even though you might think that maybe there are some cases you could get away with them. We don't, it isn't in our interest to just calculate in each case whether we could get away with breaking the rules. What's in our long-run interest is that we always follow the rules. Now you might say, well, aren't there occasional exceptions to this, like, say, the famous case that Kant discusses. There's a murderer knocking on the door, and he asks if a certain person he's planning to murder is in the house. So do you have to answer yes if the person is there? Do you have to tell the truth to a murderer? And most people say, no, you don't. So there's an exception to the rule that you're not supposed to lie. Kant actually thought you should tell the truth in that case, but most people have. He was rather strange in some respects. But so you might say, well, aren't there sometimes exceptions to these rules? But Hazlitt said, well, maybe there are, but these two can be specified as rules. So it isn't sort of up to each person to decide each time when they're supposed to violate the rules. We have these fixed rules and it's taught to us that are ingrained in us. And if we follow those rules, it's in our interest because they make social cooperation through the market possible. Here we have a picture of Moses, I think, holding the Ten Commandments. Moses, of course, was the first person to break the Ten Commandments and got the first set. And he came down and saw the people worshiping the golden calf. He threw the plates down and broke them, so he was the first one to break the Ten Commandments. And I'll just give you one more comment on the Ten Commandments that Bertrand Russell said about the Ten Commandments. They should be approached like a final examination at Cambridge. Only 6 out of 10 need be attempted at one time. So because of the benefits of social cooperation, then it's not really in your interest to violate the rules of morality. So even in cases where you think you could get away with, say, stealing or doing something that you think, say, suppose you could, by lying, you could get a better job. You could say you wanted a job and you were in competition with somebody else, or you start a false rumor about that person, and then the job goes to you. They might think, well, isn't that to your advantage? But according to Hazlitt, it really isn't, because it's in our long-run interest that people observe rules of morality, because this enables social cooperation through the market to function. So really, in this view, respecting the interests of others is really a way of advancing your own interests. So there, in Hazlitt's view, there's no real opposition between egoism and altruism. Say, and if you say an egoist is, say, someone who's just concerned with himself, and an altruist is someone who tries to help others. Sometimes people will oppose the two, say, well, shouldn't be an egoist or an altruist. So what Hazlitt suggests is there isn't that much of an opposition between the two, in that by following the rules of morality, which help others, I'm really advancing my own interests. Now, the point that Hazlitt makes here, which is you get, this is one that he emphasizes much more than Mises. You don't find this point as strongly mentioned in Mises. you do find it very much in Friedrich Hayek, is this. Suppose we say we need to have certain rules in order for social cooperation and the market to function. Well, we have these general rules that we can figure out, like respect to other people's property, but don't we also need very detailed rules, say, suppose you're respecting other people's property, that isn't going to tell you very much unless you know what are other people's property is, what are the rules that establish what other people's property is. And according to Hazlitt, many of the rules, the more detailed specifications of these general rules, come to us through custom and the evolution of law. So, especially there are situations, say traffic rules, where we have to have some rules, but the details don't matter that much. Say, you have a picture of a red light, that which would be stop on red. Now, we could have had a system where you stop on green and go on red. So it doesn't really matter how we construct the signals as long as we all follow the same rules. It wouldn't be a good idea if, say, somebody, say we have in our system, we stop on red. If somebody was following his own rules, said go stop on green and go on red, we get into a lot of trouble. So what we need is everybody to follow the same rules. So what Hazlitt said is in those cases, we should follow what's customary or follow the legal precedent simply because those, by doing that, we're advancing social cooperation. So we shouldn't say, well, this is a point Hayek makes very much, when we have one of the customary rules, the legal rule, we shouldn't say, well, I have to have some argument showing that this is the best possible rule. No, according to Hazlitt and Hayek, what we need is to have a rule in order that people can know what others are going to do, and by following that rule promote social cooperation. I remember a story when there was on traffic rules, there was a woman who was listening to the news on TV, and she heard that there was a wrong driver driving the wrong way on the freeway, and she got very worried because she knew her husband was someone who would be driving that way at that time. She was worried that maybe her husband would be in an accident. But the husband arrived home, and she said, "Did you see anything about somebody driving the wrong way on the freeway?" He said, "It wasn't just one person, there were hundreds of them." So I think this is, again, this is just to illustrate, you know, we need traffic regulations. It doesn't matter what they are so much as long as people follow them consistently. Now, Hazlitt's approach here, I've just taken this as a pretty freestanding approach, just trying to explain Hazlitt on his own terms, but he's not the only person in history philosophy who's thought about morality in this way, although he and Mises have their own emphasis, is somewhat different from other people. But Hazlitt is what's called the eudaimonist or utilitarian tradition. Eudaimonist comes from the Greek word eudaimonia, which means happiness or satisfaction or flourishing. So according to this way of looking at morality, morality is viewed as a way of promoting people's happiness. So you can see how Hazlitt comes into this tradition. And he's saying people want to achieve their long-run happiness, and following the rules of morality will enable the market to function. We need social cooperation. It's indispensable for people achieving their long-run happiness. So he's saying, really, morality is a way you could be promoting people's happiness. Now, there's another view of morality. It's called a deontological view. This is one Kant is famous for, philosophy would help this view. It sees the laws of morality as unconditional all. So in this view, what's wrong with what Hazard is saying is Hazard saying, if you want happiness, then you should do such and such. So what this other view is saying, no, that doesn't really get the real force of morality. Morality is just an unconditional audit telling you, you must do this regardless of whether you want it or not. And in this contribute to Hazard, morality is not for anything else. It's not that if you want such and such a thing, then you should be moral. It's just morality that imposes certain demands on us. And Kant tried to show that it would be there with these were just strictly requirements of rationality. Other people said, no, they're just unconditional laws that aren't even demands of rationality. We just see that we ought to do certain things. That's it. So that's very much in contrast with Hazlitt's view. Now, one interesting when Hazlitt has a lot of interesting material on the history of ethics in the book, and he's particularly concerned with writers in this demonist or utilitarian tradition. And one that he discusses at quite a bit at length is Jeremy Bentham, the famous utilitarian. And I think it's interesting if he has a much higher opinion of Jeremy Bentham than Murray Rothbard does. I just finished a course where we were going through the second volume of Rothbard's book on the Austrian perspective on the history of economic thought. And Rothbard has an extremely negative view of Bentham, but Hazlitt rates him very, very much higher. That Hazlitt says that Bentham had very good insights on how egoism is related to altruism, and thinks he had good things to say about the nature of various moral virtues. But he thinks that Bentham made a fundamental mistake, that when Bentham said that we want a person morality to promote happiness, Bentham thought we could add up people's happiness and say, well, supposing somebody says, let's have a minimum wage law, then we could say such and such a person will benefit by it, and you can add up all the people who benefit, how much they benefit, and we see who are the losers, and we could kind of add up all the pleasures and pains, and then whichever course of action had the greatest balance of pleasure over pain, that would be the one to do. So the Hazlitt-Mises approach doesn't do that. All but there's no attempt to add up utilities or to determine what particular actions within particular case, individual cases would maximize everybody's happiness. In the Hazlitt-Mises approach, the concentration is entirely on general rules. That is, say, those general rules that would best promote the working of social cooperation through the market. And Hazlitt thinks that David Hume, who, remember, the second fantasist of the great philosophy, was really the first person who grasped the importance of general rules in morality. So I think at this point, what I'm going to do, and I probably a lot of you have questions, objections, things you'd like to discuss. So I'm going to go now to the Q&A box. I'll click on that. And then if you have questions, please type them in there.
And David, is it okay if I read them out loud to you?
Wait, I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Is it okay if I read them out loud to you?
Oh, sure.
Okay, here's a question. Can you explain the morality in the case of a traffic light? If there are no cars passing and it's a red light for pedestrians, is it moral to cross the road?
Ah, now that's an interesting question. You know, the great French historian, medieval philosopher, Etienne Gilson, once was made fun. He said an American is someone who would stop for a traffic light in the desert. So I think here, I would think this might be a case, if you're really sure there's no pedestrian, this might be a case where Hazlitt would say maybe there's an exception, but this would be, have to be carefully hedged about. Maybe you have to be very careful. You know, maybe there's a police. You'd have to, first, you know, you have to be very careful. Maybe there's a policeman watching you in case you make such a... See, I think the basic point, though, here's a take question for the series of conspiracy. In these rules, even if we could see in particular cases, we could get away with breaking, like in this case, well, there are no pedestrians, what's the need to wait? It's still good to follow. Maybe this wouldn't apply with such strictness to this case of a traffic light, that isn't such a big deal, but for other things, we do need to, at least according to Hazlitt, we do need to follow the rules strictly. We're not supposed to calculate what our individual advantages say. You're not supposed to say, well, here's a case where I can just shoplift and get away with it. Okay, let me see. Now, there's a question here. Who are some good authors to read who dispute the is-ought dichotomy? You might have a look at Arthur Pryor had a book, Logic and the Basis of Ethics, and Peter Geach and Elizabeth Anscombe have written on that. I think also if you go to the media site, if you look up some of Roderick Long's papers, he would be one who doesn't accept that. Some of the I think the objectivists don't accept it either. Let's see, there's one here from Donna, more of a comment. I personally appreciate your adjustment to he and she or whatever, not because it's politically correct, but because it's respectful of both genders, and I feel more included by gender neutral and dual gender words and phrases. Thanks. Oh, well, I'm glad I put it in there. Okay, now Daniel asks, how is ego and altruism not at odds against each other? Well, I don't think the claim would be that there's no opposition between doing something for yourself and doing something for others, but the claim would be it's not as strict as you would think, in that by respecting other people's rights, you're helping them, but you're also helping yourself, because the system of social cooperation through the market is one that benefits everyone. So the fundamental point here is that there's a harmony of interests among people. It isn't that we're all at odds with each other, so if I'm benefiting, you're losing, that we're all benefiting by the system of social cooperation. So in that way, if I follow the rules of morality, I'm helping others, but I'm also helping myself. Somebody had question number two. I guess the first one was question on the track line. Morality of a prostitute. If she has a need for money, no other skills, takes all precautions, not hurting anyone, what is the case here? Well, that, I think Hazlitt really doesn't deal with that case. I think he's more, when he's dealing with morality, he's just dealing with the rules of social cooperation through the market. So I think he would think that should be legal. I mean, he doesn't really address questions of personal morality, like if that is engaging in that sort of activity, something involving degradation of one's personality. That would be the sort of, he doesn't really address that question. But within the terms of just that he's talking about, namely social cooperation in the market, I think that wouldn't rule prostitution out, but we might still have other questions about it if we brought in other moral points of view. But I mean, just Hazlitt is just concerned with limiting this particular area of morality. Now, someone said, how does Hazlitt's Is Ought you compare with Ayn Rand's view? Well, that's something I'm going to be giving a course on Atlas Shrugged in July, so we'll begin with her view. But basically, what she thinks is that there are certain things that we need, human beings need, in order to survive. If we didn't have these things, we wouldn't survive. And she thinks it follows from the fact that we need certain things in order to survive, but we ought to do those things. I think it's part of her account of the concept of ought, that we need, that we ought to do these things we need in order to survive. So if you compare what she said with Hazlitt, it's similar in that Hazlitt said, if we want to achieve our long-term interests, we should do such and such things. And she says also that if we want to survive, we should do such and such things. But she also thinks it's part of our human nature to survive, so that if we say, well, we don't care about surviving or doing things that we need to survive, then according to her, we can't make any other choices at all. We're just, because the choice to live is the basis of all other choices. There's actually a dispute among objectivists, if people interpret that, is how much is she accepting this hypothetical, if you want to live, you should do such and such. How much does she make it just a requirement? You ought to do this. There's no if about it. But if you read her one way, she's quite similar to Hazlitt, but the basic difference is that she thinks if you reject doing what's in your long-term interest, she doesn't think you can make any other choice. And Maury says, could we say the division of labor encourages social cooperation? Well, I mean, it not only encourages it, it constitutes it. We couldn't have extensive social cooperation without the division of labor. So, I mean, we could have that society's very primitive or small society where there wasn't much division of labor, but for any kind of large-scale society, we would need to have division of labor. And Daniel said, so if someone still thinks breaking social cooperation will benefit and it's going to be worth it, he's out of hands with morality analysis. I mean, what he says about these people, they have a right to do not follow moral rules if they disagree. Well, I think what Hazlitt would say there is he thinks if we have too many of these people, society won't be able to function. So it's very desirable that people are taught to obey the rules of morality pretty near absolutely, and that we don't want to have such people, as you suggest, around me. I don't think he would want to say, if it turns out that you are one of these people, then other people should just let you do what you want. But he just thinks we ought to. It's a good idea that we construct our society so not many of those people turn up. Especially that I have to ask, it is unclear to me what Dr. Gore's position is regarding ethics and morality. I was curious to see if this is a justification of it, as far as my hazard, which is merely an explanation of hazard approach. Well, it's much more the latter. I think this is, if you're asking my own view, I think it's a very important way of looking at morality. I don't know that I agree with it entirely. I think there's a great deal to it, but what I was concerned here was much more explaining Hazlitt's views than trying to give my own misguided views of morality. So that was a very good question, but I'm going to evade. If you mean you want me to give my own views, I'm going to evade that. You'll have to, that could get me into a lot of trouble, so I'm not going to go there. Now, Maury asks, are the rules of morality the same as the rules of social cooperation? Now, that's a very good question. I think Hazlitt seems to suggest a very close relation between them. I think there could be aspects of morality, though, that aren't included there, like, say, personal ethics. Say, the questions there that would come up, like the previous question, morality of prostitution or morality of abortion might be issues that don't directly concern social cooperation, but we want to call them moral issues, I think. But Hazlitt is almost entirely interested in the part of morality that deals with social cooperation. Now, Oswald said, what does morality have to say about national debts which the unborn have to pay? Well, I think that might come in this way, that if you say reason promoting social cooperation through the market, as it would then probably go on to argue that it's the free market that best we would want. We wouldn't want a social system which was very heavily regulated by the government, because that wouldn't work. So I think he would say indirectly morality might be against very high national debt, because that would impede social cooperation. Now, Sebastian said, what is his position regarding Hoppe's argumentation ethics and Stefan Kinsella's Estoppel approach? I'll tell you, it was very interesting. I said to several people before this lecture, I'll bet someone asks about Ayn Rand, I'll bet someone asks about Hans Hoppe. So I'm glad. I like being right, so I'm glad that you did ask that question. I just wanted to check something. It's a different person. I just want to see if it's the same person you asked. So now, the problem here in answering that, remember, I think Hazlitt really died before Hans Hoppe or Stefan Kinsella really developed an approach. He might have been alive a bit. He might have overlapped with Hans's work a little bit. As far as I know, he never commented on them. But his approach is quite different from either Hans's argumentation of it or the Kinsella Estoppel approach. Not that you couldn't endorse both if you wanted, you couldn't be it. They have this right to endorse Hans as well. But in the Hans Hoppe approach, claim that if you deny that you own yourself, you're involved in a certain kind of contradiction. And Han tries to derive a kind of a libertarian ethics from this type of argument. So this is different from Hazard's book, because Hazard's saying, remember, it's hypothetical. If you want your long-term interest, which you do, you should promote socialist cooperation. Hazard doesn't contend you're contradicting yourself if you reject what he's saying. And Stefan Kinsella's approach, something is, as far as I understand that, he's saying something like, if you don't recognize other people's rights and they're free to do what they want to do. So that actually might be a bit more similar to Hazard's approach. And if he's right, then that would be a pretty good reason you should recognize other people's rights. So that would be a bit similar in that respect to Hazard's approach. I mean, Hazard doesn't have the premise, if you don't recognize other people's rights, then it's all right morally for them to do whatever they want to. Hazard just says, well, if we don't all follow the rules of morality, then society won't be able to, social cooperation won't be able to function. Now, Kendrick says, if a rule does not lead to long-term self-interest, wouldn't this contradict his moral argument? No, because he's concerned with the rules that do advance long-term interest. So he doesn't say, well, whenever you have a rule, that's it. We could come up with all sorts of rules that wouldn't help us. But what he is saying is, sometimes, or very often, we have certain rules that do advance our interests and have, we need to have traffic, we need to have certain legal rules defining what property is, but the exact details of the rules don't matter as much as the fact that we have fixed rules that we obey, so in those cases we should follow those rules. Now, Angel says, to be happy I must obey moral rules established. Well, what he's saying is that in order to be happy, you have to live in a system of cooperation with others. You can't just live by yourself. In order to have such a society, you have to obey the moral rules. So indirectly, so you have to obey the moral rules of relations happening. It goes through the social cooperation, so it's something you, in order to be happy, I need to be in a cooperative system of social relations with other people, and to have such a system, people need to follow the moral rules. Now let's see, the next one is, Matt says, what did Rothbard have to say about these views from Hazard? It seems like Rothbard is much more than the natural rights traditions, isn't it? That means that is right because it simply is without consideration for utility, etc. Well, I don't think that Rothbard specifically addressed Hazlitt's book on morality. He thought very highly of Hazlitt in general. I remember there's one unpublished report he had on Hazlitt's book on Keynes, Failure of the New Economics, which was his analysis of Keynes's economics, and he said, I didn't know Henry had it in him, that he was very impressed with Hazard's economic theories. And I think you're right that Rothbard is in the natural rights tradition, and I don't think you would say that this tradition is one that's completely divorced from utility, because the natural rights tradition, the way Rothbard took it, is saying we get certain rights because these are requirements of human nature, say that we need to have the life or to acquire property. So it wouldn't be that the, according to Rothbard, the rules of morality are just there. What is this famous poem from remembering Charge of the Life Brigade? dares not to question why, dares but to do and die. That is what Roth or Fury thinks the natural right to very much to benefit. Now, Jaya said, in the system, in their unrealistic amount of emphasis on ability for human beings to ex ante have the knowledge of what is long-term happiness. Do you think long-term happiness in itself has to be answered by some of the system? Well, that's an excellent question, but you see, Hazlitt isn't really making a very extensive claim on what we need to achieve long-term happiness. It isn't that he has some kind of blueprint that, well, here's what you need in order to be happy. And then I think your question would come in and say, well, how do you know that? How do you know what people really need to be happy? He made a much more limited claim that sort of whatever we think we need to be happy, something is a necessary condition for us to achieve that kind of happiness, namely having a system of social cooperation in the market. So it's a much more limited claim, you see. I don't think that's unrealistic, that in order to deny that, you have to say, well, we, so far as we know, people might just be able to get along without cooperation with others, and that doesn't seem very plausible, I don't think. Now, Donna said more of a comment. Yes, that was the gender neutral. And now we had another one, compare Hazlitt and Hoffa ethics. Yeah, that one I answered already. That says, is there any hope in restoring morality in the United States when half the country is living on welfare and doesn't understand they are living off other people's money? Well, I guess, I'm just going to have to rely on education. Maybe it's a good idea to concentrate on the half that isn't living off other people first. Now, Edric says, is it moral for the media to turn factual events to morally judged reporting? I'm not sure exactly what you mean there. You mean something like the journalist will give his or her own moral judgments on the way they're reporting things. I mean, I would think that would depend, that would be an interesting question. It would just depend on how much they interfered with the accuracy of what they were reporting. Now, Tony says, my principal just happened to fall in line with someone who can profit from them without providing rent-seeking legislation. Should I be concerned about their support of my candidacy for elected position? In other words, you have a proposal that you favor for various reasons, and it turns out that they benefit somebody in particular. Would that be a reason to be concerned about their support? Offhand, I wouldn't think so. I mean, as long as you have good reason to support the measure, but I have to have more details about the case to give you a better answer. Now, Andrew says, what are the common objections to the long-run interest conception of morality? Are there any figures throughout history who made solidified attacks on this premise? We could really, I think, distinguish kind of two ways of attacking what Hazlitt is saying. One would be, that I mentioned in the lecture, is it's wrong to talk about morality in terms of interest at all. Morality is something that is directly derivable from rationality. On top of might come in some of the oldest conflict. Or you could hold moral truths are simply out there in the world and people grasping that morality isn't for anything else. And now another way of attacking this view would be to say, why long run, say, if you say, what is what it means to say people should be concerned with their long-run interests. Why is that? If you say something like, well, in the long run, they'll be better off if they are, isn't that just repeating the claim that people should be concerned with their long-term interests? What if there's something you want to do now that conflicts with your long-term interests? Why shouldn't you do that? But the answer is that that will conflict with your long-term interests. That just saying, well, you should follow your long-term interest. Now, my take has it, one might say, well, has it is saying people do want their long-term interest. He isn't saying that you ought to, whether you want to or not. He says, in fact, people do want their long-term interest. But I think that people might question that. Say, some people don't. I suppose that might be one way you could attack as so-minded. Now, Cale says, there are definite non-arbitrary limits to what can be an exception, what cannot. Fine has this exception somewhat subjective. Well, I think here, I think you would have to make an important distinction between saying that an exception is something that we would have to have a lot of knowledge of particular cases to be able to formulate what the exception is. Remember, Hazlitt wants to make the exceptions into rules himself. We want to say, well, we need quite a bit of detail to specify what the exceptions are. But it wouldn't follow from that, I don't think, if we needed some kind of detail to specify what the exceptions are, we couldn't really list all of them in a general way in advance, that would make them arbitrary or subjective. They just might be ones that would require our informed judgment about them. It wouldn't be arbitrary, it would just be ones that you'd have to think about and be able to come up with answers to them, just from the fact that you might not be able fully to specify them. I don't think it would follow that they were arbitrary. Objective, but I think you're right, that is a possible area where Hazlitt could get into trouble if it turned out you really couldn't specify the objection as much as he wanted. Now Joshua says, how does the harm principle fit into Hazlitt's views? I'm not sure, maybe you could explain a bit more what you mean by the harm principle. I'm not really clear on that. Now, Scott says, I understand the economic consequences of long-run and short-run interest, but how does a tariff factor into moral judgment? Well, I think what Hazlitt would say there is that, say, in the tariff is supposed to be benefiting particular people. Say we have a tariff on steel. This will help the steel producers, but other people won't benefit or be harmed by it. So I think where morality would come in is Hazlitt would say, well, if we want to promote the system of social cooperation through the market, the best way to do that is to have a free market rather than just have one group trying to advance its economic interests at the expense of other people. I think we bring morality in to say, well, people who favor tariffs are trying to help certain people at the expense of others, but in a system of social cooperation, everybody who engages in an exchange will benefit from it. We wouldn't have an exchange if both people didn't expect to benefit from it. Now, Fred says, do rules of morality depend on the degree of social interaction? Robinson Crusoe could go through a red light without disrupting social cooperation. Well, that's a very good point. I think what Hazlitt is concerned is what's required for social cooperation. So I think you're quite right if you weren't concerned with Robinson Crusoe problems, that wouldn't affect Hazlitt. That wouldn't really come into Hazlitt's point, I mean, you might think, well, there are certain virtues that you might develop really for social cooperation, like hard work, not just doing what you immediately wanted, but considering the long run that would also help people survive who were just by themselves, but that wouldn't be the primary emphasis in what he's interested in. If so, how long would it take society to rebuild its morality? Well, I mean, that would just be, I think, an empirical question. Dan says, who is John Gall? Well, maybe we'll try to find out in July when I get the course on Atlas Shrugged. I remember, you know, Hayek's comment on Atlas Shrugged was he thought it was an interesting novel, but he omitted reading Galt's speech at the end because he thought it was too long. Now, Nathan said, assuming a person ought to follow social rules, in fact, the longer interest supports that person's happiness, this sounds like the tragedy of the commons. Can you comment? Well, that's interesting. I think a tragedy of the commons would be a case where the absence of certain kinds of rules, namely ones delimiting property rights for individuals, will lead to bad consequences. So, tragedy of the commons is really another sort of looking at Hazlitt's argument from the other way around. Hazlitt is saying if we have rules for social cooperation, if we have social cooperation with Mark, we need certain rules like observe respecting other people's property. So we need to have defined property rights for people, then we'll be able to have cooperation through the market, we'll all be able to achieve our long-run interests that are needed. In the absence of social cooperation, tragedy of the commons would be an illustration of what happens when we don't have such rules in place. Now here's one. So is it morally correct to do anything one pleases as long as that's an injury? Is it morally correct then to sue as long as you do not get caught? Oh, no, not in Hazlitt's view. Remember, in Hazlitt's view, you should follow the moral rules because by everyone following the moral rules, that will produce a better system if you try to calculate what you should do in advance your immediate interest in each case. So, what you were suggesting is morally incorrect to do anything at least as long as you advance your short-term interest. So that would not be a canceled approach. Now, Edric says, if class warfare results of a deficient set of moral rules in society, I think one could say how class warfare arises in particular situations would depend on particular historical factors. You would have to examine the concrete instance of class warfare, but it's certainly the case that if people realize that they need common rules in order to promote social cooperation, then there wouldn't be class warfare. Now, Craig says, whether the demonist label on derivation of often is, has it used in very close to David Norton and to Rand's objective ethics. Would you say there are any major areas of disagreement there? I think that's a very good point. I think it is somewhat close to David Norton. I remember I met him once, and like a very interesting, nice fellow. Interesting, you read him, not too many people read him anymore. But the extent to which Hazlitt is similar to Rand would really be depending on how there's a difference of opinion interpreting Rand in how much emphasis she thinks is on this hypothetical. If you choose to live, you should do such and such. I think one point of difference is I don't think Hazlitt would say if you don't choose to advance your own interest, then there's no basis for any sort of choice at all. I don't think he would go along with her there. Now, Stephen says, if rules in the form of laws aim social cooperation, does it follow that a rule should be determined for every conceivable action after today's progressive legislation? An overabundance of enforceable law to do social efficiency. Well, that's a very good question. Remember, all of the rule that there wouldn't, it wouldn't help social cooperation to have a rule for everything. The reason we need rules in Hazlitt's view is so that people have some expectations of what others will do in situations so they'll be able to make peaceful exchanges with other people. We don't want to have rules regulating what those exchanges are, but we just need very general rules, say, giving what people's property rights are so that people can engage in peaceful exchanges with each other to their mutual benefit. So we wouldn't want to have rules for everything. Oh, now this question I'm going to Hazlitt believes that in the interest of social cooperation, one ought to follow traditional work within the confines of it for change. Yes, that's very right. John says, so assumes to be morality purely utilitarian. Well, that's very much disputed. I mean, he had certain elements that were utilitarian, others maybe not. He seems to emphasize a more custom or following certain, he doesn't, I mean, I think he is somewhat of a utilitarian, but sort of not. There are other elements of his thought as well, but that's much as the topic. Have you ever mentioned ideas like natural law? Well, I think he does have some sort of an idea of people following certain rules that are established by convention that become things that they ought to follow simply because conventions have developed make it useful to follow them. So something along the line Hazlitt was suggesting. So I think that's the closest it comes to natural law. Okay, we had that question already. Morris said for Hazlitt, moral activity build up social cooperation. Kant, moral activity commands determine social cooperation. Well, that sounds like it could, there's something to that. I have to think about that in more detail, but that could well be. I mean, that's an interesting way of putting it. Here's one. Don't you think morals are innate to him? We really need to write them down and publish them and learn them. Don't we know it by ourselves naturally? The question of innate knowledge is one that Hazlitt really doesn't deal with. But I don't think it would follow that if we have certain innate knowledge, we wouldn't need to write them down and say, it's been argued by Chomsky and others, we have an innate knowledge of principles of language, but we still need to have written language write things. I mean, if it is the fact that we have innate knowledge of certain kinds, it wouldn't follow that we don't to write them down. Well, I'll just take a few more. I think we're about out of time now. And I'll try to just answer the rest of them. Hello?
David? Oh, sorry. We did advertise it for 2 hours.
Oh, we did? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I thought it was just till ending at 5. Okay, well, in that case, we're not out of time. I'm glad you mentioned that. Okay, so, hello? Oh, so I have another half hour to go. I hope my voice holds out. What does Hazlitt think of political laws that seem unjust? Should the individual follow them so that respect for the laws remains intact? Well, I don't think he specifies any position about civil disobedience, but you're certainly right that he would consider respecting the law is one consideration to be fully in mind. I mean, we could remember, it's the principles and morality that he thinks we ought to accept, even if they go against our immediate interests. He doesn't apply that to all principles of law, although he does say some we should treat custom and law as extremely important because they might be used to specify the rules of morality, but I don't think he's committed to any, something like civil disobedience is always wrong or anything like that. And now, let's see, Bob said, let's say I don't value or care about accepting social constructs that benefit in the long run. So how can anybody judge me if I rob a bank or torture a puppy? Is morality subjective? No. Now, you remember, according to Hazlitt, remember, morality is at least the part of morality he's concerned with, is determined by what advances social cooperation. So if you behave, say if you rob a bank, you're certainly acting in a way that impedes social cooperation. So you'd be doing something wrong in Hazlitt's view. Whether you cared about it or not wouldn't really matter much. I mean, it would just show your, if you said, well, I don't care about any of this, I think Hazlitt would say, well, then you're not acting to achieve your own long-term interest. And he said, well, I don't care about that. He might say, probably, he might say, well, if you thought about it, you'd see you really did care, or if you didn't, you would be one of the just a few exceptions and people would just have to act to prevent you from doing what you want. So what we have to distinguish, try to give you a better answer, is we have to distinguish two questions here. Are there possibly people who might not feel the force of Hazlitt's consideration, say, somebody who really said, well, I don't care about long-term interests, or this doesn't mean anything to me. Possibly there are such people, although Hazlitt's right, not very many of them. And second question would be, does the fact that possibly such people exist imply that morality is just a matter of what, and you do what you want? No, that wouldn't fall, because if Hazlitt is right, almost everyone wants his or her long-term self-interest, and this can be achieved by social cooperation. We need the rules of morality to get social cooperation. That makes that is the objective, that constitutes the objectivity of morality. Now, Mark says, what is Hazlitt's view of Mill and on liberty? Well, in general, he has a quite high opinion of Mill. He doesn't discuss Mill in the book as much as Bentham, but I think I think in general he thought highly of Mill. Again, that would be a point where Rothbard differed with him. Rothbard doesn't like John Stuart Mill at all. But I think Hazlitt would have thought pretty highly of Mill. That question we answered. Hazlitt edited the book Wisdom of the Stoic. Did Stoics influence you that much? Well, I think there are differences between the Stoic point of view and Hazlitt's point of view, but Hazlitt, I think, would like about the Stoics would be their stress on and discipline and a calm attitude toward things. But the Stoics thought basically you should you achieve happiness by really concentrating on the present, not making your happiness dependent very much on other people is what will happen in the future. You should try to achieve an attitude where whatever happens, you just take calmly. So you're avoiding being upset. Supposing you're extremely attracted to some person and you feel, well, it's very important you love this person. It's very important that this person feel that way toward you. If, say, this person doesn't want to get involved with you, you'd be extremely upset about that. The Stoics would say, well, you should try to avoid being dependent on people in that way, because then if the person rejects you, you're going to be very unhappy. You should just concentrate kind of on your inner state of mind. So I don't think that would really be a particularly hazard somehow. The approach between hazard, if you put that search. But hazard is more stressful. In this book, regardless of what you want, the way to achieve the what you want is really to have a system of social cooperation with others. It isn't really concerned with how you achieve personal happiness with free market system established. Okay, next question, which is interesting to someone with who comes in under the name Cactus God. I take it that's a pen name rather than your given name. Is that hazard approach morality from an atheistic or theistic point of view? Well, what he says there is, I mean, the approach he takes is a purely secular one. He has a chapter on religion ethics. So, I mean, remember, his argument is we need social cooperation through the free market, and then he needs certain rules. So that isn't bringing in any reference to God, but it doesn't exclude existence of God either. And what he says, he's very, in the chapter, he likes what's called the Euthyphro dilemma point that's made in the famous movie, Plato's Dialogues, where Socrates, and Euthyphro, where Socrates says are something good because it pleases the gods, or does it please the gods because it's good? And Socrates wants the answer. Well, something pleases the gods because it's good. So in that view, what's good or bad would be something that's independent of God's will, but that doesn't exclude God from existing or even from commanding things. I think Hazlitt puts himself an atheist. And in the chapter, he tends to be very critical of the role of religion, certain religions having done, be responsible for various sorts of bad things in the world. But he does include, interestingly, some remarks by the British moralist Hastings Rash, the kind of defensive kind of reasons for thinking that morality depends on God. And I think Hazlitt doesn't think much of what Rational says, but maybe there's more to what Rational says in that passage that Hazlitt is allowing. In his book, Hazlitt deals with morality only insofar as an individual is acting with others. Yes, because his aim is to look at morality with respect to social action, especially economic. Yes, I think that's right. That's the primary thing he's interested in. That's what he's trying to promote. Now, Christiane says, are all the rules equally important? Not for history and then not killing at different concepts. Should we treat them differently? Well, I mean, that's a very good point you're suggesting. Certainly some rules are more important than others. Certainly not if we would treat people who run red lights not the same way, at least in most circumstances, from people who kill other people. But the key thing to realize here, it doesn't follow from the fact that some violation of some rule has more serious consequences than others, that it's all right to violate the less serious rules, because remembering has its view, having your system promote social cooperation. So it's important that we follow all the rules that do that. Now, here's one in Hazard's view. Is it moral for the government to redistribute people's interests as a way to promote happiness in society? No, because remember what Hazard is concerned with, that we want that in the market, people are cooperating for their own advantage. You won't make an exchange with somebody unless you both expect to benefit from the exchange. But if the government is redistributing, then it's using, helping some at the expense of others. And if you look at the chapter in the book on socialist ethics, where Hazard goes into it, says, well, the socialist is trying to benefit some at the expense of others. Socialists are trying to impose a scheme of values on other people. But that isn't the point of morality according to Hazard. What morality is doing is having a system of rules within which we can all cooperate to our own advantage, not benefit some at the expense of others. Now, Lawrence says, does Hazard allow for positive moral rules, and if so, is it permitted to be enforced by the state or just within the context of customary law? I think, as far as I know, Hazard does allow for a state, so it wouldn't just be a system of customary law. Bruno Leone, I think, thought we could get along without any legislation. I don't think Hazard took that point of view. In fact, in other of his books, I think he had a book, he favored a change in the U.S. Constitution. He liked the British parliamentary system of government better than the American one, so I think that was something he favored. Now, Johan says, what are other fundamental rules like property rights that support social cooperation? Well, I think property rights would certainly be very important. I mean, we would have what would be some other rules, like, say, one to say that required to say we should be honest with each other, people, or that we should avoid insulting people, or any of the standard rules of morality would be ones that could come in there. It isn't that Hazard has some kind of unusual account of morality to give, that he just thinks you take what we ordinarily could consider to be morality, the justification for it is that it promotes social cooperation. I've got to elaborate, what is the moral argument of sugar quota? Well, it would be that kind of quota benefit some people, mainly the people who grow sugar at home at the expense of others. But they would harm others, so that would be a way of interfering with social cooperation. Okay, now that says, who decides the rules of morality? I like the answer I do, but that's not what Hazard says. Well, in Hazard's view, these rules aren't really decided. We need to have certain rules in order to promote social cooperation, and we can kind of figure out what we need. We need to have certain property rights, say, that social cooperation, and then within those general categories, then people do have to kind of figure out what are the specific rules, and that is just, there isn't, Hazard doesn't have a particular view on which particular people decide that. It would just be, he generally says, well, a lot of rules have come down through custom or history of law, and it doesn't really matter what the specific rules are as long as we have these fixed rules. So it isn't anybody who particularly decides on the rules, it just kind of evolves in many cases. Sometimes you do have to have people deciding on rules, but it doesn't have a definite view on who it is who's making these decisions. So most morality isn't decided by people. For the whole society is morally good, we should teach and decide by means of rules or laws. Or is there another way? Because if so, we would be violating their freedom. I'm not sure. I'm not really getting your question. I'm not really understanding the question. I think it would be certainly right that when we're teaching people the moral rules, we have to follow the moral rules ourselves, and we couldn't just kind of force people to, say, propagandize people, get them to learn the rules. But most people learn the rules, say, morality when you're growing up, your parents teach you, and you get them from your teachers and so on, so you just get them through social training. So now Jeff says, what was happening to natural law? Well, he thought that he deals with, he has chapters on that in the book. I think he thinks that there are elements of natural law that can be fitted into his point of view. There are kind of ways that he takes certain natural law and the anticipation of these general principles, the rules that we need to promote social cooperation. But he wouldn't accept, say, the kind of views that embed natural law within some kind of religious system. Of course, natural law is supposed to be something you can just derive from reason, but I think so. He thinks certain natural law views can be interpreted as precursors of what he wants. The question is socialism, where mean ethical argument. Well, he has, I think, remember, he has a chapter on eudaemonism. He has something where he discusses Kantian ethics. It's, I think, it's toward the second half of the book. You could get it pretty much from the table of contents or the index. I mean, it will have a discussion of eudaemonism. And here's one: if society is organized around the egoistic realm, would that lead to hyper-division of labor, specialization beyond what a free market would develop? So each person is trying to advance his own interests. And I'm not sure why. Now, it would depend, I guess, as long as the egoists realize that division of labor would advance his own interests, I think he would certainly favor division of labor. I don't see why that would lead to more division of labor, say, than someone who wasn't an egoist, or why, if it did, that would be more than the maximum, the more than what a free market would develop. I'm not following how that argument's supposed to go. So maybe you could explain that a bit more. Now, Jose says, in pursuing my happiness, why should I respect your rules? I can keep the short-run benefit of breaking it while the long-run harm is disseminated among the whole society. Well, that's a very good question. The basic answer, I think, has to be if people acted and thought in that way, then the whole system would just break down. So it's very much in our long-term interest that we're taught or educated not to think that way. But if somebody could think that way, I mean, that if you know, people started thinking that way, then the whole system would break down. So it is a very good question. That is actually a weak point in Hazlitt's analysis. I think can it really handle that sort of problem? And I suppose that you had a case where, say, the you just don't, you were supposed to be taught always to observe morals, but you just the education didn't take, and you just have this kind of attitude, I'm just going to observe these laws when I think I won't be able to get away with violating. I'm not sure Hazlitt would have a good answer to that. I mean, I think somebody would say, well, it's very desirable that people be educated so they don't think that way. Now, here's one. What if a man's desire goes against society and mind might hate society? Wouldn't it be impossible for Hazlitt to apply to them? Why should we accept Hazlitt's hypothetical odds if he can't show why we ought to accept the hypothetical odds? Well, I think what Hazlitt would say there is it's not so much to say what we need to do is come up with answers to people who hate society or people who just say is that in fact people do, in his view, accept his hypothetical and they people want to advance their long-term happiness. So it's not that we need to, in his view, we need to have an argument that we ought, in some other unconditional sense, to accept the hypothetical odds, more that we do want to accept the odds. It would be something like, supposing I say something like, anyone who attends this lecture will get, will be paid $1,000. I'd probably get a lot of people who, even more than come to the lecture actually, who would sign up for it. But that would just be because people would want to get the money. It could be that some people don't, but we could say probably most people would want to get it. It wouldn't be that we'd have to come in and say, well, here's why you ought to have money. We just say, that's the way people are. They do want that. So I think that's what Hazlitt would say. People do want their long-term happiness. Maybe there are a few exceptions, but people do want this. Now, here's one. Benham is often quoted by animal rights activists extending morality to animals. Does Hazlitt go into any detail about what qualifies one as a moral agent? Would he agree or disagree with Bentham? Well, he doesn't. You're quite right. Bentham does take does have an argument for having duties toward animals. He says the criterion is does the animal suffer? Well, animals suffer, so they get pleasure from things, so we need to take them into account. But Hazlitt's approach, he wouldn't really go that way, because remember, Hazlitt is concerned explicitly with happiness of people. He said, well, how do we achieve our long-term happiness through social cooperation? So he doesn't really go into that issue at all. Remember, Bentham does, because Bentham is concerned with adding up all the pleasures and pains, but in Hazlitt, you don't do that. You're just concerned with general rules that you need for social cooperation. Kyle says, what about the man's long-term interest is not in harmony with social cooperation? For example, someone who wants power over others. But I think what Hazlitt would say there, I think, would be even such a person would have to recognize that he needs to live in society with others and can't have power over others unless there is a society, social cooperation. So you would have to, in Hazlitt's view, you'd have to restrain your desire for power over others so that it wouldn't interfere with the system of social cooperation, because if you didn't do that, you wouldn't be able to achieve your long-term interest. You wouldn't be able to get power over others if there's no society. So I think he would take that as pretty much, and to the extent that it conflicted with social cooperation, pretty much they become kind of an anti-social desire. Now, Martin says, most of you can't see the Q&A questions, so we post the questions in chat. No, I can see, all you need is to see your type in your own question. That's why I'm reading the question, so you'll know what questions are being asked. But I can see what you I can see all the questions, so that's how I'm able to answer them. Now, Matt says, how are we to judge whether Hazlitt is right or wrong, i.e. what he recommends a moral thing to do? For example, if I were to disagree with following the if-then principle is immoral rather than moral, what would be Hazlitt's response? Well, that's interesting, you know, this is one we tried to cover before, but it's good you ask us, because I think it's an aspect of Hazlitt's view that I think is very interesting. It's kind of, I think, a little hard to grasp right away. See, Hazlitt isn't saying, I can show you that you have to adopt this perspective whether you want to or not. What he's saying is, this is one that if you think about, you'll find you do want. So what he would say is, it's not that if it turns out you disagree, he has some argument to show you shouldn't disagree, that you want your long-term happiness. He says, well, if you think about it, you'll find you do want your long-term happiness. Colin says, Benton's mummified head is on display in University College London. A student there told me he participated in a soccer game with Benton's head. Rothbard would oppose this behavior in principle of property rights. What should Bentham's view be? Well, I guess Bentham would say it would depend on what would what would best promote pleasure over pain. So I don't think Bentham might say if it violates property, it might violate the legal rights of Bentham established by law that Bentham using Bentham's head in such a way would violate certain legal principles. It would promote utility to follow those principles of Bentham, which might oppose it also. Now, here's one additionally. Do you know much about Bertrand Juvenel's arguments against redistribution, how it relates to Hazlitt or other moral traditions? Well, it's been a while. I read Juvenel wrote an essay at the Ethics of Redistribution. Well, I think he was quite compatible with Hazlitt. I think he was suggesting that redistribution has certain undesirable consequences. For example, that there are certain goods that, say, if wealthy people have, they'll be of benefit because, say, wealthy people will have the goods first and then other people will imitate them and they'll be able to get the goods later more cheaply. So it's kind of a benefit that we not interfere with wealthy people. We should allow wealthy people to have their wealth. So I think that's quite compatible with what Hazlitt said, but I recall it's a very good essay, but I don't think it's really developing a whole system of morality, but I think it's quite compatible with what Hazlitt is saying. Now, Scott, there's your only immediate short-term consequence of lawmakers and continuing implementation of such a policy. Well, I think lawmakers need to consider both immediate and long-term consequences. I'm not quite sure about exactly what means. He says, how would Hoppe and Hazlitt be inconsistent? Well, I don't think they're inconsistent in the sense that they're contradictory, that you couldn't accept both. But the difference is, Hazlitt is saying, if you want something, if you want your long-term happiness, you should do such and such. And Hoppe's system is not based on a hypothetical, even if it's a hypothetical, everybody would accept it. Oh, and here's one. I think we're about out of time, but I'll just take a few more now. Let's see, sorry, press for changes. If we own ourselves and follow our long-term interests, we maximize the value of property in ourselves. I think that would be true, but I mean, that wouldn't be intrinsically part of Hans's system. I mean, that might be a way you could show you could follow both. Roger says, what does Hazlitt say about intolerant desires and what people desire, not long-term happiness, but everyone converts to their religion? Well, I think he thinks there that kind of desire will interfere with promotion of social cooperation. So I think he's thinking that if people really thought about the consequences they decided, they would see that that wasn't one they should hold. Okay, let me just take, Leslie said, I think Conley argued that things such as slavery and murder are wrong in themselves, not just improving in the short or long. Yes, I think that's right. He certainly would say that. In fact, he says, even if we knew that society was going to dissolve, it would be, we should execute the last murderer, because justice requires that. Chris says, if you're anticipating dying, let's say you have cancer, would I be immoral then to break the rules in the round? I guess what I'm getting at here is, how does one objectively define the long run, what would hazard think of such a suggestion? Well, hazard doesn't discuss that. Actually, that sort of example has been discussed in the literature, and some people have given that as an objection. Okay? Well, maybe if you get older, you don't have to be concerned about the long run, because there isn't going to be such a long run for you. But I think hazard is thinking, again, it's to everybody's interest that we all inculcate these principles, so we wouldn't really be thinking on this individual basis of, is this long run going to be good for me? But we'd all sort of absorbed these principles in our education. So remember, so we're not thinking all the time, well, I'm going to follow this moral rule because bank in my long-term interest. It's not something that really occurs to us in our individual deliberation. It's just, it's to everybody's advantage, it's to long-run interest of people in general that there exists a moral system, but it isn't something that we take account of in our individual deliberations. Well, I think maybe we're about out of time now. Somebody just says, I see this is funny. I answered it. Rodney King restates, can't we all just get along? Well, I suppose that's one way of looking at it, yes. Okay, well, thanks everybody. So I hope you can come to some of the courses in the Mises Academy. I just see one question that could one argue that hate speech laws encourage social cooperation and therefore a just law? Well, I don't think they would. I mean, they would be, they wouldn't be part of this general framework of laws we need for social cooperation. They would be really trying to impose certain values on other people. I think they wouldn't encourage social cooperation. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Thanks for coming to my lecture. So hope we'll see you all again in other courses. Thanks a lot. Bye, everybody.